Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear from a child welfare advocate who's survived 10 years in Florida's foster home system, where she was shuttled between 14 homes in that time, many of them quite abusive, before being adopted into a loving family at age 12. Today, Ashley Rhodes Corder is a college graduate with a master's in social work and a passionate advocate for child welfare. Her previous book, a memoir, Three Little Words, which referred to her ascent to adoption, details her life in Florida's child welfare system. Her new memoir, Three More Words, details her adult life as an advocate and a foster parent herself. To date, she's been the foster parent to over 20 children. And she reminds us today that foster systems in nearly every state in the country need better systems and more money to protect children adequately. In fact, Oklahoma's system of foster homes, managed by DHS, is currently being monitored in its own improvement plan as a part of a settlement of a federal lawsuit. The Pinnacle Plan has noted improvements to the system, but serious deficiencies as well, with high turnover, high caseloads, and failure to maintain child abuse hotlines. Today, Ashley Rhodes Corder shares her stories, a foster parent and an advocate on the behalf of children. Ashley Rhodes Corder, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your first memoir described your journey through Florida's foster home system and eventually your adoption to a pair of what sound like amazing, loving parents. This book recounts your journey since then and how that relationship has grown, but also a relationship with your biological family and your own experience as a foster parent. Going into becoming a foster parent after spending time in 14 foster homes growing up, what were the things you wanted to avoid and one of the things you wanted to do as a foster parent?
Right. Well, like you said, my first book, Three Little Words, talked about my experiences growing up in foster care, and they definitely weren't the most fabulous at times. I had a lot of families that were convicted felons and had problems with drugs and alcohol and violence, pedophilia. You know, they definitely weren't the most desirable placements. So as I became an adult and healed with my adoptive family and went on to college and I got my master's degree in social work, I really always had this desire to give back. And even as a teenager, I felt compelled to advocate for the other kids that were in foster care, for people who had experienced things like I had. And eventually my husband and I became foster parents. And I was really hoping to better the system with my story through my experiences. I felt like I could really connect with these kids on a really amazing level because I had been where they were prior to become foster parents. My husband and I were guardian ad litem, which are CASA volunteers, and we worked exclusively with teenagers. And that was really eye-opening and I think helpful for the teens. I helped some of my teen girls do normal things like go to prom and get their hair done and get a driver's license and kind of fill in the gaps that were being neglected by their providers. So that was really great. And then we were like, wow, we really wanted to do more. So then we opened up our home to be foster parents. And people like to look at my story and say, you're 29 now. Your story is ancient. It was so many years ago. But then the cases and the stories of the kids that we had in our home, we've cared for over 20 children, and their stories are just as bad as mine, if not worse. So it became apparent very quickly that there is still so much work to be done and that these children need an advocate and need homes and need families more desperately than ever. So I'm hoping that in my book, Three More Words, I talk about becoming a foster parent. I talk about, I have to bring readers up to speed from the first book. Of course, it's a sequel. So I talk about going to college and making stupid mistakes, meeting my husband, balancing the relationship with my biological family and my adoptive family. But the second half is all about our fostering experiences and eventually adopting our son. And I'm hoping that those stories really become a call to action and inspire people to join this cause and be a voice for a child, because we're talking life or death situations. In February of this year, we had one of our former foster kids was returned to relatives that she had been removed from, and she was murdered by an uncle living in the home.
Oh, my gosh.
So that was our worst fear as foster parents, and I think that experience reinforced for us how critical it is to be advocates and never give up on these kids. And even though these situations can be so brutal and so emotionally tough, these kids need someone to speak up for them.
And in the book, you recount a story of the first foster child that was removed from your home because relatives had I guess a father had claimed the child. And it was really heartbreaking in a way because you were really trying to connect with him, let the child know that the child was loved, you know, and that he already had like these big defense barriers up already, you know, from being in the system. And just as when you're starting to make inroads with him, it's like, boom, back out of the house.
And that's really frustrating. I think every time a child leaves your home as foster parents, you're heartbroken in many ways. This particular case was awful because the child came to us absolutely developmentally delayed, could barely speak, couldn't feed himself, was practically feral, really. And we had done all of this work, the dad was out of the picture, but, you know, there's a lot of chances that these parents sometimes get, and there are parents that can be rehabilitated and just are victims of the cycle of abuse themselves and really just need that mentor or that helping hand. But, you know, there's other parents that just can't be rehabilitated, and I think sometimes the system just isn't equipped or isn't allowed to accept or recognize that, and this child did end up going back to a father that really, in our opinion, hadn't made great strides, was barely squeaking by. There were periods of 6 months where he never even visited the child. And it was absolutely devastating and heartbreaking. And in our family, we really believed in reunification. Our goal was to get children back to their families. That's the point of foster care, is to do what we can to help strengthen the families of origin for these kids. But it's really crippling when children go back into unsafe situations. We had one little girl that was reunified. She came to us. She was 2.5, had multiple STDs, had literally been raped since infancy. And
wow.
She was reunified to her mother that admitted in staffings that, oh, well, I didn't think it was a big deal. That case as well, it haunts you, you know, sometimes forever. But every time a child leaves, it wasn't 24 hours that passed before the phone was ringing again and there was another child that needed us. So we just have to constantly remind ourselves what we're committed to and why we're here. And the kids in your home, you know, they don't understand bureaucracy. They don't understand all these intricacies. They just need someone to hug them and heal them and give them a warm meal and a soft bed and read them stories and reintroduce them to the normalcies of life that so many children get every day and, you know, so many of us take for granted. But these kids are just, they light up with just the smallest bit of stability and kindness. It's really amazing.
Now, your own story, when you were 12 and adopted, the three little words were, I guess so.
I wrote three little words because, for me, my adoption wasn't this rainbows and sunshine kind of occasion. I was 12 years old. I had all of these disappointments. I had been horribly abused. I didn't believe in happily ever after. I didn't believe that that was something that was in my cards. And I write very candidly about my fears and reservations, and there's an entire chapter in the book entitled Testing, Testing, where I push every button my adoptive parents had, but they never gave up on me, and it kind of got to the point where I was like, man, I can't get rid of these people. So I think it was just their dedication and their determination to not give up on me, and they would say, Ashley, we had nowhere to send our biological children, and you're no different. So you really messed up, girly, but we're going to deal with this like a family. And it was life-changing for me. It was huge to have that kind of commitment, and no one had ever showed that to me. So it really laid the foundation for the adult and parent that I am today. And, you know, I thank them so much for that.
I was struck by one of the things you wrote in the first days of being adopted. And it's a small telling statement for those who've never experienced something like you have in your life, and that is, I walk in the kitchen and there's no locks on the refrigerator.
Right. Well, yeah, no, and that was, I mean, adapting
sure.
to an adoptive family. I mean, I lived in homes where they literally, the cabinets, the refrigerators, there were locks. Or I lived in group homes where we went to a cafeteria and everything was very rigid and scheduled. And there were no spontaneous snacks, or all of these kids get institutionalized. And so it's sometimes very difficult to, you know, have your own bedroom. I was like blown away. I got my own room and I had pets and I got to have sleepovers with friends and play sports in the community. And again, do all these things that most people think are really normal, but they're huge for foster kids. I mean, there are laws and bills and people that have to support normalcy rights for foster children because they're not a given. And these kids, you know, especially in previous years, they didn't get to just have overnights or get a driver's license, like I said earlier. You know, these things are monumental, but there are these normal milestones that are so important for kids. And without families and without support systems to help these kids go through these stages of life, then they don't get to experience them. And I think it's almost impossible for a child to become a productive, successful adult if they don't have these rites of passage, if they don't know where they've come from and who they are, and they don't realize all that they've overcome just by being who they are.
Well, psychological data tells us that if you have more than a couple of caregivers in the early part of life, statistically, the outcomes are not good. I mean, just a couple.
No, truly.
Yeah.
Well, and I've
and,
always,
and you had 14.
Right. I've always believed, especially for 0 to 3, 0 to 5, there should be an entirely different set of child welfare laws and policies when it comes to these children. Because, again, we've had very little ones that we've raised for a year, year and a half, and then poof, they're off to somewhere else. I mean, those moves are crippling for very, very young children. And interestingly, and for foster children, it's not necessarily being in out-of-home care that is totally crippling. It's the number of moves that create the most damage. So when you have these kids bouncing home to home to home, like you said, sometimes these are things that kids never recover from sometimes, and they have PTSD, and they have all of these issues for the rest of their lives. They have attachment problems. They have cognitive deficits. Their brains don't develop normally. So it's just essential that stability is provided for these kids as quickly as possible. And I think that permanency and that stability comes in lots of different forms. Sometimes it's reunification with the parents. Sometimes it's with a really good relative, fingers crossed. But sometimes that's adoption. And I think these permanency outcomes need to be achieved much more quickly than they are. And we need to stop dragging out these case plans, having kids in foster care for years, even though the laws have changed and that's not supposed to be happening. We have to make sure that we're ruling for the best interest of the child, not the best interest of the parents, not the best interest of the financial department, of the agencies. You know, this really has to be about an individualized approach for the child.
Now, when you're bouncing around from foster home to foster home, is that just the foster home system switching a child from one set of foster parents to another? Or?
Well, there are a million reasons children move around. In my case, I bounced around so frequently because, A, sometimes my foster parents were felons or got into legal trouble, and they said, oops, we better take those kids out. Once I was moved to live with my grandfather in another state, and he got into a gunfight and was shot in front of us, so they said, oops, we better move those kids.
Oh my God.
Sometimes my brother and I were separated, so they would move us into a home to be together, and then something would happen, so they would take us back out into different homes, and then they would put us back together. We had one little baby that came to us. He was 6 months old. We were his fifth placement. And the placement prior to us called the agency and said, you have to take this baby because my dogs aren't getting enough attention. So, I mean, sometimes it is the smallest of slights like that, or sometimes it's a much bigger problem. Or maybe it's a foster home that's just retiring and they're closing down their home. Or maybe there's an actual legal problem and the home gets shut by the agency. So there are a multitude of reasons. There's also different levels of foster care. There's therapeutic foster care. There's medical foster care. So sometimes a home, you know, for instance, if a child is born drug addicted, oftentimes they'll go to a medical foster home. But once the baby detoxes and is healed, they have to go into regular foster care because medical homes are specific for children with medical needs. So sometimes a move happens just because of that. We were really upset because at one point we started out as traditional foster parents and we did the extra training to become therapeutic foster parents. And we had a little one in our home that wasn't labeled as a therapeutic child. And when we switched our license to be able to provide care for sort of a higher level child, they took the baby from us that had been with us for over a year.
Oh my
because
gosh.
They said, oh, well, he's not therapeutic and we don't want to pay higher subs. And we said, well, we don't want the money. We just, this is going to be devastating. And this was a little boy who within, you know, weeks or a couple of months max was slated to go to a relative. And we were like, you know, we're at the end game with this baby. Like, what are you thinking? And again, it was all bureaucracy and paperwork and subsidies and all the wrong reasons. And they took this baby out of our home and created this additional move and additional trauma for him. So, and these things are just sometimes out of your control.
My guest today is Ashley Rhodes Corder, a child welfare advocate, a foster parent, and the best-selling author of Three Little Words and her sequel memoir, Three More Words. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I know you've studied child welfare issues around the world, really. Are there models we should be looking at here in the United States for a better system? You know, Oklahoma, we actually were under a lawsuit, and we settled the lawsuit, and it was supposed to add more caseworkers for every child so that the ratio was lower. And I don't think any of that thing's happened because the state's been under such severe budget restraints. And I think there's talk of reviving that lawsuit at this point because the state hasn't carried out as much of the settlement as they should. What needs to change in our child welfare system?
Well, I think one of the problems is that there really is no uniformity. What we're doing in Florida is different than what we're doing in Oklahoma, is different than what they're doing in California. And sometimes these best practices aren't shared state to state. But also, the fear and the problem that I'm seeing is that the pendulum now has swung far too much in the other direction. And when I was in foster care, they were removing children for the smallest of slights. And so we had a hugely overcrowded foster care system, hugely overcrowded foster homes, and this huge burden. But now, especially in Florida, they're removing kids under, like, no circumstances. And, you know, there have been times I've had to call the abuse hotline, and they'll say, oh, we can't take that call for this. And the threshold for what they'll actually send out an investigation for, it seems crazy. Like, they'll say, oh, well, drug use isn't a big deal as long as the parents aren't using drugs in front of the child. And CPI, the Child Protection Investigation teams from the sheriff's office, they're trained to, you know, pretty much remove as infrequently as you can, and that if the family has what they're calling a safety plan, it basically says that they can be drug users as long as they have a neighbor watch the kid while they go on a bender, or they shoot up in the bathroom instead of right in front of the kid. I mean, the standards for removal now are so low, and it's resulting in fatalities left and right. There have been over 240 deaths in Florida this year reported to the hotline, and many of them were under preventable circumstances, like our little girl. So these are pretty scary times, and I think that we need to be, again, like I mentioned earlier, taking an individualized approach. We can't be saying, oh, you're one of seven siblings? Well, we have to keep them together. Or, you know, my brother and I were adopted separately, and it was a huge saving grace for me because my brother has a lot of severe issues. So if we're only thinking about systemically what the trend is, oh, well, right now the trend is reunification and biological parents can do no wrong, and it's getting kids killed. So sometimes reunification is awesome, but sometimes the child needs to be streamlined to adoption. Sometimes siblings need to be adopted separately, but sometimes we need to fight tooth and nail to make sure that the siblings stay together because their bond is genuinely extremely strong. And I think, again, if we're taking a one-on-one approach to each child and acting within best interests of that child, that alone will make a huge difference.
I think the whole child welfare system is about policies and procedures, and what you're advocating is probably counterintuitive to that. I mean, it's basically taking each case on a case-by-case basis on what's best. That's
right.
That's incredibly difficult.
It is, but I think we need to be putting the child back in child welfare, because right now it's all about budgets and numbers and what you have to do, and frankly, we have really great laws here. We have this, you know, law that says case plans need to be completed within 12 months, and, you know, a family has 12 months to get it together. But the laws and all of these policies are only as good as the people who are implementing them. So we have to be following the law that's in place and having these laws trickle down to the agencies. For instance, that mom that sat in the staffing that says, oh, it's no big deal that I knew my baby girl was being raped, that is a failure to protect. That's breaking the law. In Florida, if you fail to report child abuse, you can spend up to 5 years in jail. So why is nobody taking action for these kids? And no one's, again, following the law as it stands. And that alone is problematic.
Yeah. Now, you did go to other countries to see what their child welfare systems were like. What did you find? Did you find a better model?
It's hard to say one specific model. I've spent time in China and South Africa, and what I can really appreciate about the model that I see, especially in Africa, is this kind of village mentality. And that's certainly something that we're still struggling with here in the States. You know, there's an organization called Orphan Aid Africa that really focuses on this kind of family-finding principle that we have here, where these villages, and granted, Africa has, I mean, and China, just millions of orphans, that their population is five times that of what we have going on here. So their struggles are very different in a lot of respects, but they really embrace children, and they have this mentality that it takes a village. And I think we really need to get back to that here, where we're looking out for one another. You know, when you see a family that's struggling, you know, don't be quick to judge. Don't be quick to just pick up the phone and make an abuse call. First of all, the abuse call is likely to not get screened anyway, but it's like if you can help a family, we should do that. We should be building one another up, taking responsibility for each other, and really raising kids has to be a community effort. And if we don't all collectively join forces to help these families and raise our communities, then statistics just show that we deal with them in the next welfare system, which isn't good for anybody in our society as a whole. So I really like the idea of being mentors, you know, reaching out and helping a struggling mom, providing child care so these kids don't get left with questionable paramours, provide education, and, you know, really, really try to help one another more than just point the finger and condemn them and turn a blind eye to the causes that are right in our own backyard.
One of the things your adoptive parents did was they encouraged you to keep open the lines of communications with your birth mother. How important was that? I know it's been a very tough relationship at times.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say my adoptive parents encouraged it by any means, but they were not about to stand in my way. So if I had questions, if I had issues, you know, they were just open to fielding all of these things. If I wanted to be in touch with my mom, they would help make it happen. And they were there for me as my emotional airbag when things imploded in my face, as they did so many times. So they were amazingly supportive. And I think it's critical for children to have access to their past, know their histories, have that mystery erased, because, like in my case, it was really, I was able to better bond with my adoptive family because I didn't have this yearning of, oh, well, where did I come from? I didn't have these unanswered questions. And, you know, every time I would kind of dip my toe into the pool of my biological family, I feel like something would happen. Or, you know, we joke, oh, it's like the flesh-eating bacteria that's in the Florida waters now. You know, like, that would always happen. But luckily, I had this safety net of my adoptive family. And I think each adoption journey is very, very different. Some adoptees have adoptive stories where, you know, maybe the mom was a teen mom, but now she's a really productive member of society, and they have a great relationship having contact with both. But with our foster kids, a lot of times we've unfortunately experienced that these families come from just multiple generations of dysfunction and crime, and it's not always necessarily safe. But, you know, we're going to be battling these issues when our son gets older and wants to know about his history and his family, and a lot of it is pretty dark and scary. But I think the underlying theme is that you have to know. You have to have that information. Otherwise, you'll spend the rest of your life questioning and wondering. And there's nothing more healthy than having access to this information. And at the end of the day, no child can ever have too many people who genuinely care about them and who will progress their life in a positive way. So as long as these family members are productive members of society and are a good influence on the child and aren't going to put them in harm's way, then I would really encourage adoptive families to not be afraid of giving their kids that information, because in my situation, it definitely strengthened the relationship that I had with my family in the end. You know, I'm sure there's those few years where my parents were kind of nervous, or, you know, there's this fear that, oh, they're just going to run back to their bio families. And, you know, maybe that'll happen. Maybe when my son gets a little older, he'll favor his birth mom because she doesn't make him do his homework or eat broccoli. But I think the end game, you know, it was my adopted mother that was holding my hand when I gave birth to our first biological child. You know, it was my adopted dad that's here at my house helping me fix my leaky roof. You know, these are the people that are there for me for the rest of my life.
Now, you've had a number of foster kids in your home. I mean, and some for a short amount of time, some, I suppose, for a longer amount of time. You know, you've had such terrible experiences in many cases in many of the foster homes you were in. What's the home relationship you try to foster with these kids that may only be there for months or maybe a year or more?
Well, as foster parents, we just sort of got into a routine, and these kids really crave stability. So behind the scenes, we would work on getting them caught up academically, working on whatever elements of their case that they needed. If they were behind in school, if they were, you know, behind nutritionally, one little boy came to us and all of his teeth were rotted out, so we just had to make sure that he got you know, really top-notch medical care for his teeth. And these kids have a variety of issues that had to be dealt with. And with our little girl that had been sexually abused, we got her into a really great program with a therapist who did play therapy, and we did yoga to kind of help her use her body in a different kind of way. So she loved toddler yoga. And other kids, we've been able to help them connect with animal-assisted therapies, or just using whatever creative resources we have in our community through classes or museums, or just being a part of a regular family. And we try to meet their needs as best we can while they're here. And there's so much trauma and loss that comes with foster care, but our goal as foster parents is just to create a layer of joy and happiness and good memories, even if it's for the smallest amount of time. And I really have to believe that those moments and those stories will stay with them in some way for the rest of their lives. Foster parents really make an incredible impact, even if they don't realize it. I suspect that, you know, maybe in 20, 30 years, we're going to have some knocks on the door, and maybe then kids will come back and say, oh, I remember you. But as I've probably done for my former teachers and caseworkers and people, you know, we find you. I'm still in touch with my guardian ad litem CASA volunteer, you know, all these years later. So these relationships really are lifelong.
I think that would be some of the most difficult things. You put all this work and time and love and effort into a child that may only be with you for a few months. And then once that child is gone, I assume the system doesn't want you communicating with that child at all.
Right. They call it confidentiality. And so, you know, a lot gets protected. You don't get to communicate with kids unless, of course, you know, you build, let's say a child goes back to the family and you've worked with the family and the biological family is willing to stay in touch with you. That happens really frequently, especially with this new model in foster care where they're really encouraging foster parents to be mentors to the biological families as well. So there's lots of opportunity to stay in touch with the child if you've established those relationships. And it is hard to, well, it's not, I have to be full disclosure. Sometimes it's not quite as difficult because let's be honest, you don't necessarily click with all kids. You provide, you know, amazing care and they'll never know the difference. But sometimes you definitely, like a child leaves or a really difficult sibling group and you're like, whew, you know, you have this sigh of relief. But again, you know, we're the adults, and I have a friend that was like, you know, these kids deserve to have someone who cares about them enough to cry when they leave. And sometimes these kids have never experienced that kind of devotion. So I liken it to a teacher. You know, some teachers connect really closely to some of their students, and at the end of the year, you know, the kids move on, and the teachers are kind of able to let them go. And sometimes the students come back and thank them, and, you know, sometimes the kid doesn't do well in the next grade, maybe comes back a grade, whatever the case may be. But I think it's a similar service.
Do you think the idea of foster parents serving as a mentor to the biological family, is that a workable model in some cases?
I think in theory it's fabulous. Some of these parents they don't know what it means to be a parent. They need a little help. Maybe it's a teen mom, or maybe it's a woman who is a victim of domestic violence, or whatever the issues may be. Sometimes it really can work where they really see the family as a mentor, and you know, it's for the foster parents, it's kind of like fostering two kids. However, in full disclosure and in all honesty, we've only really had that work like twice in all of the kids that we've had. And those times that it worked, it wasn't with the biological offending parents, it was with relatives. One was an aunt and one was an elderly grandmother, who were sort of removed from the cycle and the circle of the dysfunctional offending parent, and they were awesome placements.
Ashley Rhodes Corder, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Child welfare advocate Ashley Rhodes Corder speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. The best-selling author of Three Little Words is now the author of Three More Words, her new memoir, which is published by Athenaeum. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.